Chapter 16.
As I've said to you guys several times, to bring everything home and have it credited to your account isn't quite as easy as wading in clay and having water at hand to wash your feet afterwards.
Howard was taking up this problem once more. It seemed that he could think of nothing else, and to him this problem had become really acute since they had decided to close the mine and leave for the port. He simply couldn't free his mind from the difficulties which he foresaw would be theirs on the march. He went on.
Did you ever hear the story about that treasure-burdened woman, the most honorable and distinguished Doña Catalina Maria de Rodriguez? I'm sure you haven't, because there aren't many people in this world who have. I mean, of course, the real story. With her, it was not the question of how to get the gold and silver, but how to get it home, where it would have done her the most good. Gold is of no use to anybody as long as it is not where he wants it. It seems that in the Villa de Guadalupe, there is an image of Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, that is, Our Lady of Guadalupe, the holy patroness of Mexico and all the Mexicans. The little town is a suburb of Mexico City and can be reached from that city by streetcar. Now, to the Mexicans and the Indians of Mexico, this image is of great importance because whoever is in trouble or pain undertakes a pilgrimage to that shrine, feeling sure that the Holy Virgin will help him out of his worries, whatever they are. Our Lady of Guadalupe has a very great heart, and she understands fully the depths of the human soul. She is even supposed to help a peasant to a piece of land which belongs to his neighbor, and to help a girl out of the natural consequences of a wrong step. Anyway, the Mexicans know how to use her to their benefit, and so do the holy persons who take care of the lady and are in charge of everything, including collecting the fees. Oh, that's all superstition. To hell with all the people who coin money out of the superstitions of the ignorant.
Curtin interrupted the tale.
I wonder,
Howard said.
You have to believe, and then it will help you. It's the same with the Lord. If you believe in the Lord, then there's a Lord for you. If you don't believe in him, there's no God for you. Nobody who lights up the stars for you and directs the traffic in the heavens. Now, don't argue about such details. Let's come to the plain story. I'm telling you that story just as it happened.
At about the time of the American Revolution, there lived in the vicinity of Huacal, in northern Mexico, a well-to-do Indian farmer, who, in fact, was chieftain of the Chiricahua Indians. These Indians, very peaceful people, had settled in this region hundreds and hundreds of years before, and had found more pleasure and riches in tilling the soil than the neighboring tribes, who went marauding whenever they felt like it. The chieftain, who was otherwise so blessed with well-being, had a great sorrow which overshadowed his whole life. His only son and heir was blind. In former times, this son would have been done away with right after being born. But under the influence of the new religion, even the Indians had become more generous in such things, and the child, as he was otherwise normal, was allowed to live. The boy was a strong and healthy child, handsome and well-formed. He grew not only in size but in intelligence, and the nearer he came to manhood, the more sorrowful became his father. It so happened that a monk came that way, a holy person, who understood well how to live on the hospitality of the Indians without giving them more in return than an occasional story about events supposed to have taken place between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago concerning people entirely different from the Indians. Finally, the monk felt that he had to do better if he wished to stay longer without having to plow and to sow for his living. Besides, he needed ready cash for some purpose or other. So he began bargaining with the chieftain, telling him that for a worthwhile consideration, he would give him advice as to how to win the grace of the Holy Virgin and make her do what no doctor ever could do, give light to the eyes of the chief's only son. The monk was expert in giving good counsel to the suffering and afflicted. He had been trained for it.
Of course,
he explained to the chief,
this heavenly grace of Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe is not easily gained. You understand, my son, such a great lady cannot be treated like an ordinary hussy. Therefore, do not spare the rich offerings, as the Holy Virgin, just to make it quite plain to you what I mean, is always in a very receptive mood towards money in any form, and also jewelry. And so are the most holy persons who wait upon this great lady.
For this sure remedy, the monk expected his own reward at once, as no one, regardless of how holy he may be, is expected to live on hope for the manna which once came, but which may never come again. The monk, having received his pay, gave the chief, his wife, and his son his blessing, and went on his way to find another tribe that might be willing to support him well for telling stories about miracles. The chieftain left his possessions in charge of his uncle, gathered together all the money and the jewelry he had, and went on his long pilgrimage to Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe. No horse, mule, or burro was to be used on this dreary way. With his wife and son and three servants, he had to make this journey of nearly 1,400 miles on foot. At every church on his way, he had to kneel down and say 300 Ave Marias and to offer the church a certain number of candles, a silver eye, and money. To make this pilgrimage last as long as possible may have been of importance to the monk for reasons of his own, but since he was a loyal Christian, let us presume the journey had to be made in this way so as to be a success. The chief reached Mexico City at last, after having made his offerings in the cathedral, confessed, and prayed there for a whole day, and with special blessings from the fathers, he went about the last part of his hard task. It is slightly more than 3 miles from the cathedral to the image of Guadalupe. These 3 miles the chief, his wife, his son, and his three servants had to walk on their knees, and each of the pilgrims had to carry in his hands a lighted candle, which must not be permitted to go out, no matter what the weather. If a candle should burn out, it had to be replaced with a new one. Since the candles had been specially blessed in the cathedral, they were far more expensive than ordinary candles, and whenever a new one was lighted, 100 extra Ave Marias had to be said. It should be added that the Ave Marias were practically the only prayers the chief and his family knew how to say. So they went chanting and praying all the way, being blessed and crossed by all the faithful persons who passed by. On the knees, any trip will last long. So this journey lasted all afternoon and the whole night through. The little boy fell asleep, but was wakened again and again. He whined for water and for a tortilla to eat, but it was against the rule to eat or drink in such a pilgrimage. Not everyone who passed by blessed them. Many shrank in horror from the little group, thinking what terrible sinners they must be to have been commanded by the church to go through such an ordeal. Wholly exhausted, they reached the base of the Cerrito de Tepeyac. This was the hill on which, in the year of our Lord 1531, the Holy Virgin in person had appeared to the Cuatlatahoa Indian Juan Diego, and had left painted in his hayate, a sort of overshirt, her picture. No one had taken notice of this miracle at the time it happened. Not until 100 years later were the faithful reminded of the fact that this miracle had occurred on the 12th of December, 1531. But the picture was there, and it was framed in a costly gold frame, where it can still be seen, and it has brought and still brings to the church more money than a successful comedy on Broadway makes for its producers and owners. The story of the image, true or not, was of no importance to the chieftain, who was in sorrow, and the story has never been of consequence to anybody who has come faithfully to the shrine and asked the help of the Virgin. 3 days and 3 nights the chief, his wife, his son, and his servants prayed on their knees before the image. They did not eat, they did not drink, and they used up all their strength to avoid falling asleep. But nothing happened. The chief had promised the church all his cattle and his whole crop for the year, should it please Our Lady to light the eyes of his beloved son. On the 7th day, as the Virgin still refused to perform the expected and paid-for miracle, the chief, urged by the clergy in attendance, offered all his worldly possessions, including his huge farm, to the Virgin, in exchange for the eyesight of his child. Still no miracle took place, and the chieftain began earnestly to doubt the power of the Virgin. His own gods had done better under similar circumstances. The boy had meanwhile become so weakened by the long fast, the constant praying, and the attempts of his parents to keep him awake during these days, that his mother finally asserted herself, took her son out of the church, and, Virgin or no Virgin, devoted all her time to the boy, saying,
I prefer my boy alive, even if blind, to a boy dead who could see once.
The chieftain, being desperate, said now quite openly to the priests that he did not believe any longer in the virgin, and that he would rather go home and have the medicine men of his tribe treat his son's eyes once more. The fathers accused him of blasphemy, and warned him furthermore that were he not an ignorant Indian, they would take him before the court of the Holy Inquisition and torture him into swearing away his heathen gods, and then fine him for his blasphemy until he and all his relatives had nothing left and would be grateful that he was spared the fate of so many unbelievers who were burnt alive at the stake on the Alameda. Eager not to lose the whole tribe of which he was the chief, the fathers explained why the Holy Virgin had refused him help. Perhaps he had not said 300 Ave Marias in each church on his way. It might have happened that he had said only 280 in some places, and he might even have skipped a few churches, being in a hurry to reach the shrine. The Virgin knows such things, and he could not cheat her as he perhaps had done with his own gods, who could not see farther than to the top of the nearest mountain. Possibly he had drunk water in the morning before crossing himself and saying his prayer. Perhaps he had made mistakes with the candles on the last stretch of his pilgrimage. The chieftain finally had to admit that it was possible that he had not always said the full number of Ave Mamas, and this was not his fault, because he was not used to such high figures, and he might have skipped a few. And he remembered now that he had drunk water hastily without first crossing himself, because it had been very hot and he was thirsty, as he had given away all the water they had carried in pumpkin bottles to his wife and his son, who were dying in the heat. So the fathers said that under such circumstances he should not blame the Virgin, who is stainless and blameless forever and ever, but should blame only himself, because he was a great sinner and not an asset to Christendom, and he had better go back home and repeat the pilgrimage after 6 months, when the Virgin surely would grant him what he asked in good faith and as a true believer in the Church. The chief, however, had lost faith in the power of the goddess, for he was an Indian who belonged to a tribe that always received the rain its medicine man prayed and danced and chanted for, a goddess that cannot or will not help men when in need and in pain is no good for an Indian. He took his family and returned to Mexico City, ate and drank heartily, and was happy once more. He even took his young wife again into his arms, as he had not done since they had left their home, for the monk had told him that if he committed such a sin, he would lose the grace of the Holy Virgin. While in Mexico City, he was looking about for a doctor whom he might consult. He was given the name of Don Manuel Rodriguez, a famous Spanish doctor, who had become prominent on account of an eye operation performed on the wife of the prefect of the city. Before this successful operation, he had been but a quack. Having made a careful examination of the boy's eyes, he told the chief that he was sure that he could cure the boy, that the boy might regain the full use of his eyes.
The main question,
he added,
is what you can pay me.
The chief, clad like all his kind, did not look like one who could pay as much as the prefect had. He said that he owned a good farm and cattle.
That is not cash,
Don Manuel said.
What I need and what I want is cash. Money, you know. Heaps of it. I wish to go back to Spain, a civilized country. I cannot live in this godforsaken country here. And when I return to Spain, I wish to return rich. And when I say rich, I mean, of course, very rich. Your farm and your cattle don't interest me. Gold is what I want.
To this the chief answered that he could make Don Manuel the richest man in New Spain, as Mexico was called in those times, if the doctor would make his son see like other human beings. How could he do that? The doctor asked. The chief said that he knew a very rich gold and silver mine, and that he would show it to him on the day they reached his home, and the boy had his eyesight. Don Manuel was not easily convinced, so they made a cruel contract stipulating that Don Manuel should have the right, without being prosecuted, to destroy the boy's sight again if the mine which was to be his did not exist or belong to somebody else or was exhausted. Don Manuel worked as he never had worked before. He operated on the boy and treated him for 2 months with so much care and attention that he neglected all his other patients, including even men high in office. The fact was that he had become professionally interested in this case, although he did not forget for 1 hour the reward awaiting him for his labor. When 10 weeks had passed, Don Manuel called the chief and said that he might come and get his boy. The joy of the father was unbounded when he found that his son could see like a young eagle, and was told by Don Manuel that the cure would be permanent. This was true. With the gratitude only an Indian can feel, the chief said to Don Manuel,
"Now I shall prove to you that my word is as good as yours. The mine I am going to show you, and which is now yours, is the property of my family. When the Spaniards came to our region, my ancestors buried the mine, for they hated the Spaniards, who had committed so many cruelties against our race in this country, which our gods had given to us. The whites loved gold and silver more than they loved their own god. The Spaniards learned from tortured members of our tribe of the existence of this mine. They came and tore out the tongues of all the members of our family whom they could lay their hands on and, piece by piece, burned them to death to learn the place of the mine. But my ancestors laughed in their faces, even under severe pain. There was no torture cruel enough to make my ancestors reveal the mine. The more the conquerors tortured, the more did my forefathers hate them, and it was their ardent hate that made them bear all the cruelties rather than tell. The word that has come down to us from my ancestors is this. If your family or your tribe has been rendered a great service which neither the feather-crowned god of our race nor the blood-crowned god of the whites had been able or willing to render, then you shall give the treasure of the mine to that man who served you so well. By your deed, Don Manuel, this word has now been fulfilled. You, Don Manuel, have given eyes to my son and heir, who after me will be chieftain of our tribe. You did what the mother of the god of the whites could not do or would not do, in spite of all my sufferings and prayers and humiliations. This mine is now rightfully yours. 3 months hence, follow me on the road I shall describe to you, but speak to no one of what you know, and, as I have promised you, I will make you the richest man in all New Spain."
Don Manuel, having liquidated his affairs in Mexico City, went after 3 months on his long and laborious way to Huacal to take possession of his property. He brought with him his wife, Donna Maria, who had refused to stay behind and live quietly while her husband was on such an adventurous journey. The women of Spanish pioneers were no less brave and courageous than were the women of American pioneers. Don Manuel found the chief and was welcomed by him like a brother. Not alone the family of the chief, but everyone else in the tribe had only gratitude and admiration for the great doctor, who was treated as a guest of honor.
"While on my way up here,"
Don Manuel said to the chief,
"I came to think that it is rather strange that you, Aguila Bravo, did not exploit the mine yourself. You could easily have earned 100,000 gold forms, with which you could have paid me in full for my work, and I would have been satisfied."
The chief laughed.
"I do not need the gold, nor do I want silver. I have plenty to eat, always. I have a young and beautiful wife, whom I love dearly, and who loves and honors me. I have also a strong and healthy boy, who now, thanks to your skill, can see, and so is perfect in every way. I have my acres and fields, and I have my fine cattle. I am chief and judge, and I may say I am a true and honest friend of my tribe, which respects me and obeys my orders, which they know are for their own good. The soil bears rich fruit every year. The cattle bring forth year in, year out. I have a golden sun above me, at night a silver moon, and there is peace in the land. So what could gold mean to me? Gold and silver do not carry any blessing. Does it bring you any blessing? You whites, you kill and rob and cheat and betray for gold. You hate each other for gold, while you can never buy love with gold. Nothing but hatred and envy. You whites spoil the beauty of life for the possession of gold. Gold is pretty, and it stays pretty, and therefore we use it to adorn our gods and our women. It is a feast for our eyes to look at rings and necklaces and bracelets made out of it, but we always were the masters of our gold, never its slaves. We look at it and enjoy it. Since we cannot eat it, gold is of no real value to us. Our people have fought wars, but never for the possession of gold. We fought for land, for rivers, for salt deposits, for lakes, and mostly to defend ourselves against savage tribes who tried to rob us of our land and its products. If I am hungry, or my wife is hungry, what should gold do if there is no corn and no water? I cannot swallow gold to satisfy my hunger, can I? Gold is beautiful, like a flower, or it is poetic, like the singing of a bird in the woods. But if I eat the flower, it is no longer beautiful. And if I put the singing bird into a frying pan, I can no more enjoy his sweet song. All this may be how you feel, but as far as I am concerned,
Don Manuel said jocularly,
I won't put my gold into my stomach, I can assure you that, Aguila Bravo. I know what I shall use the gold for, don't you worry.
I suppose you do know, and you must know best. I won't advise you what to do. You see, my dear friend, I can serve for my acres, but I cannot and I would not serve for gold, because then I would have no corn to eat, and my wife and my son and my old father and all my servants, who all depend on me, would go hungry. This I could not bear. Anyway, my friend, I think you don't know what I am talking about and how I mean it. And I feel that I cannot quite understand what you mean. Your heart is different from mine, and your soul is not like mine. God has made us this way, yet, whatever may happen, I shall always be your friend.
6 long days did the chief, accompanied by the doctor and by 2 of the chief's men, crawl through the underbrush looking for the mine. They dug and scratched here and there. Don Manuel was inclined to misjudge the doings of the chief. He thought that the chief was only trying to get out of the agreement some way or other, and that no mine existed at all. Yet when he saw how carefully the chief searched, how logically he worked along a certain line, how he watched the shadows of the sun and compared them with peaks of hills and rocks, he became convinced that the chief knew precisely what he was doing, and that he was sure to find what he was after.
It is not quite so easy as you may think,
the chief said to Don Manuel one evening when they were seated by the campfire for supper.
You must understand, my friend, there have been earthquakes, torrential rains, landslides, changes in the course of rivers. Brooks have disappeared, and others have come anew. Small trees have grown to giants, and big trees have died. All such things have been marks to locate the mine, and these marks do not exist any longer, and so I have to look for other marks. It may still be a full week before we find the mine. Have patience, my friend. The mine cannot run away like a deer.
The search lasted far longer than a week. Then there came an evening when the chief said,
tomorrow, my dear friend, I shall give you the mine, for tomorrow my eyes will have reached it.
Don Manuel wanted to know why they could not get to the place immediately, to make sure. He was restless.
We might go right now, my friend,
the chief answered.
But it would not help us much. You see, all these days, the sun was not throwing his shadow where I had to have it. Tomorrow, the sun will point exactly to the mark. I have known the location for several days now, and tomorrow I will find the mine.
So it was. Next day, the mine was located in a ravine.
You see,
the chief explained,
there, a hill has broken off and buried all the ground nearby. You can easily see that. That is the reason it was so difficult for me to find the exact place. Too many changes have occurred during the last 200 years. There is the mine, and it is now rightfully yours. And here we part. Now I beg of you to leave my house and my land.
Why?
Don Manuel asked.
My house would no longer be good enough for you. You now own the rich mine, and no longer will happiness be yours.
The chief stretched out his hand to shake.
Wait.
Don Manuel said,
I should like to ask you something. Yes, my friend?
Suppose I had asked 100,000 gold forms to cure your son. Wouldn't you have opened the mine to get it?
I certainly would, because I wanted my son to see, and I would not have him blind if I could help it. But after I had taken the necessary gold out of the mine, I would have closed it again, for gold makes no one happy.
Besides, it might have happened that the people that ruled, the Spaniards, I mean, would have heard of it, and they would have murdered me and all my family to get the mine. Whichever way you look at it, there is no happiness in it, and all that counts in life is happiness, or what else do we live for? Take my advice, my dear friend. Take care that you are not murdered just for this mine, as soon as your own people have word that you own it. If your people know that you own nothing but your bread, tortillas, and beans, no one will murder you. I have to go now. I shall always remain your friend as long as I live, but we must part now.
Don Manuel began at once to build a camp. Aguilla Bravo returned to his home, which was about one day's distance from the mine. Before Don Manuel had left the city, he had secured from the authorities all necessary papers giving him permission to prospect for metals and making him the sole owner of the mines he should discover. Taxes he would have to pay on the shipments to the city. He returned to the town where he'd left his wife. Here he bought tools and such machinery as he needed, and also blasting powder. He hired labor and bought pack beasts. Taking his wife with him, he returned to the mine and started to open it. The mine proved so rich in silver ore that its production beat that of all the other mines. The main product was silver, but it carried a good amount of gold as byproduct. Experiences of other mine owners had taught him to say little about his find. Bandits were less to be feared than high officials and the high dignitaries of the church. These lofty persons understood well how to deprive plain citizens of their property when their property was worth the trouble. The owner would disappear suddenly, and nobody would find a trace of him. No last will would be found, and so the mine would be declared church property, or property of the crown. Furthermore, in Latin American countries, the Inquisition lasted far longer than in Spain, and its unholy power was nowhere exercised more rigorously than in this unhappy land. Against such power, what could a plain citizen do? A bishop or a cardinal only needed to get word that a certain citizen was in possession of a very rich mine, and it would not be long before witnesses would appear and swear that the mine owner had doubted the purity of the virginity of the Lord's mother, or that he doubted the miracles of Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, or uttered blasphemous speeches, or said that Luther had been just as right as the Pope. If he denied the charges, he was tortured until he not only admitted that the witnesses had told the truth, but added anything else that he was asked to admit. He was found guilty and was happy if he was granted the great mercy of being strangled before he was burned, because they might have burned him alive by a very slow fire. According to the special rules of the Holy Inquisition, all the property of a condemned man, all the property of his wife, his children, his parents, and most of his relatives, was confiscated by the church. A small percentage, according to the other rules, had to be given to the denouncers and witnesses. Don Manuel was too clever to be caught so easily. He made only very poor shipments to Mexico City, shipments that looked so cheap that he was pitied by everybody because he had to work so hard for such small winnings. He shipped only what he needed to buy better tools, provisions, and money for wages. At the mine, however, he began to accumulate and to pile up the rich outputs, hiding them away and waiting for the day when he would make a great last shipment and then leave the mine to whoever wanted what was left. Although the mine gave him great riches, he treated his Indian laborers worse than slaves. He hardly paid them enough to keep them alive, and he made them work so hard that often they broke down. Day and night he was after them, whip in hand, and using his gun whenever he thought it necessary. Indians, particularly those of the North American continent, cannot be treated in this way for long. No wonder that one day there was a rebellion in the mine of Don Manuel. His wife escaped, but Don Manuel was slain and the mine destroyed. The Indian laborers left for their homes. Donna Maria then received word that the mine was abandoned and that it seemed to be safe once more. She came back and found all the treasures untouched in the same hiding places where they had been left. She buried her husband, and then thought of working the mine again. She should have been easily satisfied for the rest of her life with the silver and the gold that had been piled up during the last years under the management of Don Manuel. On seeing this bullion before her, however, she was seized by a mania of grandeur. Hailing from a poor family in a provincial town of Spain, she suddenly imagined herself returning to her native country the richest woman in the world. She was still young and agreeable to look upon. Coming home with unheard-of riches at her command, she could buy the most ancient and beautiful castles in Spain, and she could select for her husband a member of some noble family, perhaps even a duke. She might become a member of the court of the mighty King of Spain, or even lady-in-waiting to Her Majesty the Queen. She could show the folks at home what a poor girl from a poor family such as hers could achieve in life, if possessed of intelligence. Why, the daughters of Spanish grandees had married princes of the Aztecs, of the Tarascans, of the Peruvians, and why should not she, being of pure Spanish blood, marry a Spanish marquis? From the moment when that idea took possession of her, she became a changed woman. A dormant business instinct in her awakened and made her do things she would never have dreamed of doing. She began to consider how much half a dozen castles in Spain might cost, how much a duke might spend during his lifetime, how much it would cost to keep all these castles, including an army of servants, the best horses, elegant carriages, life at court, journeys to France and Italy, and all that was essential for a really great noblewoman married to a pauperized duke or marquis. It reached a fantastic sum. She included the taxes and the special donations to the church she would have to make to be left in peace by that mighty institution. Included in these donations also was a cathedral to be built near the mine and the resting place of her husband. After she had summed up the whole amount, she decided to double it so as to be on the safe side and to cover any mistake she might have made in her calculations. It came to a figure which, when written down, was almost a foot long. Yet she was not afraid of this figure, for she was convinced that she could have it inside a certain length of time, because the mine seemed to contain unlimited riches. There followed truly hard years, in which she had to live and battle for the goal she had set for herself. Far from civilization, far from even the smallest comfort, she was at her post day and night. She knew no rest or fatigue. Whenever she felt as though she would break down, she only had to think of the Duke and of the castles in Spain, and back came all her strength. Doubtless she faced the conditions confronting her far better than her husband ever was able to do. She got along with the laborers without paying them much higher wages than had her husband. She was robust in her way, tenacious, and even hypnotic when dealing with men. If with force she could not make men do what she wanted them to do, then she tried all sorts of diplomacy, and always won them over to her will. She could laugh like a jolly drunken coach driver. She could weep heart-rendingly when it seemed expedient, and could swear like a highwayman. If nothing else would do, she could pray and preach so convincingly that begging monks would have given her their last highly treasured gold pieces. She paid her men just enough so that they always had a little more than they needed, and for that they stayed on. It was not alone the problems concerning the working men that she had to solve day in, day out. The mine was forever in danger of being robbed by gangs of bandits composed of escaped convicts, murderers at large, deserters from the army, and all sorts of soldiers of fortune and adventurers. Hordes of criminals such as the world has not seen since, and the scum of the towns swarmed the country. Mestizos, Indians, and white outlaws and outcasts. It was the time when, owing to the American and the French revolutions, the power of Spain on the American continents began to totter, and in the consequence of that, all sound economic conditions began to break up, for rebirth of political and economic conditions was in sight. For these hordes of outlaws, Doña Maria was never secure, and she had to use all kinds of tricks and camouflage to keep them from finding the treasure. When they came upon the mine, as happened at times, she had to pretend to be the poorest of human beings under heaven, working like a slave, not for her own profit, but to atone for a horrible sin she had committed against the church, to conciliate which she had to labor hard to build a cathedral. Finally, there came a time when Doña Maria was overcome by such a longing for her native land, for a clean house, for a pretty kitchen, for a beautiful bedroom, and a soft bed with a male companion in it, and for surroundings free from mosquitoes, fever, polluted water, snakes, and other horrors, that she knew she could stand this life no longer. She felt she had to leave now, or she would go insane. She wanted to see the faces of Christians again, instead of Indians, of whom she now frequently became really afraid, as a man quite suddenly may become afraid of his Great Dane for no particular reason whatever. She was longing to speak to decent persons of her own race in an uncorrupted language. She wanted to be caressed by someone she loved. She wanted to dress like the women she was thinking of, who still lived in cities. All this came over her so suddenly and unexpectedly that she had no time to collect her thoughts or to analyze her feelings as she had done formerly. She found she no longer had the strength to conquer these desires. She knew she had to go, or she would do something foolish, perhaps give herself to one of the Indians, or kill herself, or kill all the men, or take out all the bullion and scatter it about. She made a final balance of her treasure and found that it would be enough for whatever life she wanted to lead in Spain. She could not even wait a week or more so as to plan the homeward trip carefully. Lately, Dona Maria had hired two Spanish soldiers who had come this way and who either had deserted or had been discharged. With the help of these two men, she formed a special guard composed of mestizos and of Indians and fairly well armed. This guard had become necessary owing to the increase in the number of bandits roaming the country. One of the Spanish soldiers was made captain of the day, the other captain of the night. This guard proved valuable now that Dona Maria had decided to break camp, pack up, and take her riches to Mexico City, and from there to good old Spain. The transport would have been practically impossible without an armed convoy. The metal, of which about 1/6 was gold, the rest silver, had been properly smelted and was in bars. In this form, it was packed away in crates and boxes, and even in baskets made by the Indians. The value of the treasure may be figured from the fact that about 130 strong mules were needed to carry the metal alone. The pack train, accompanied by 35 men, of whom 20 were well armed, got underway. They had to march nearly 1,400 miles from the mine to the capital, through deserts, across rivers and ravines, and up 10,000 feet across the high passes of the Sierra Madre. They had to hew their way through jungles and virgin forests. They passed through the Tierra Caliente, that is, the tropical districts of the lower regions of the country. They climbed over the stormy and ice-cold ridges of the highest ranges of the Sierra and down again to the tropics. The transport was threatened by heavy tropical rains and cloudbursts, and while traversing long stretches of deserts and rocky lowlands, the beasts almost died of thirst. The transport in itself was lively enough. Dona Maria was never short of excitement. Mules, with their packs, broke away and had to be caught. Others fell and were killed, and at times their packs had to be hauled up from the depths of a ravine. Other beasts were drowned, and their packs had to be fished out of the torrents of a river. There was never a day without its own peculiar adventure. An evening came when Dona Maria found the camp stirred up. She investigated and saw that one of the Spanish captains was making trouble. He strode up to Dona Maria.
"Now listen here,"
he said.
"And listen well, lady. Will you marry me or not? And no perhaps, if you know what is good for you."
"I marry you? You? A stinking highwayman? I marry such a goddamn son of a bitch? Marry you?"
"All right, hussy,"
the man said.
"I can easily get a greater beauty. I can take it all very well without you being thrown in like a dry bone."
"What can you, cabron and son of a dog, take without me, you stinking coyote?"
"I mean, of course,"
the Spaniard explained.
"I can take, without marrying you, all that is in the packs."
"Oh, can you? Is that so? Well, you've made yourself clear. Thanks for the notice."
The Spaniard grinned at her. He waved his right hand and drew Dona Maria's attention to where the men were camped.
"Look at that, fine lady. Perhaps now you are ready to go to church with me, and after that, to bed. Or before, just as you say, dear. I'll give you just 1 hour to find out that you are really in love with me. I don't need you, see, but I'll take you just for your own sake."
"Why wait an hour? I'm not used to waiting."
Dona Maria had not lost her bearings.
"Fine work you have done, you skunk. I admit that I admire your courage. I like that type of yours."
She looked toward the camp and saw the other captain tied to a tree and all the Indians bound with ropes and lying helpless on the ground. The mestizos alone were standing up. It was these three mestizos whom the Spaniard had won over to his side by promising a rich cut of the booty.
"Yes,"
Dona Maria repeated.
"Yes, fine work indeed. You've done a very good job."
"And that means you will come to reason, my fine lady?"
the Spaniard suggested.
"I hope you won't delay any longer."
"Right you are, you goddamn devil.
I won't delay any longer.
Dona Maria said this very quietly. She stepped close to one of the many saddles lying on the ground, and with a quick move, she gripped one of the heavy mule whips. Before the Spaniard realized what she was doing, she lashed him, such a terrific blow across the face that he staggered back and fell, covering his eyes and moaning. With the speed of lightning, she gave his face a half a dozen lashes so mercilessly that he rolled over as if blind and crawled away, covering his head and his face with one arm, using the other to help him up and out of the blows. This was only the beginning. The mestizos were so stunned by what they had just seen that they did not try to run away. Before they had time to come to their senses, the whip swept across their faces. Those who did not drop to the ground ran away, hiding their heads in their arms. Not for an instant did they think of attacking the raging woman. By the time they felt safe enough to go back, Dona Maria had cut the bonds of the Spaniard who was tied to the tree and had handed him a knife to free all the Indians that had been faithful to their mistress. The Indians lost no time getting their horses and lassoing the mestizos trying to escape. Dona Maria lined them up with the treacherous captain in front.
Hey, you dirty cabrón, chingue tu matricula y abuela!
She yelled at him.
What did you say? Didn't you propose to marry me? And didn't I tell you that you will be in hell before I would even think of taking you? Hang that goddamn funking cabron and make a good job of it. Let me see how he sticks out his blasphemous tongue. Up with him!
While he was swinging from the tree, Dona Maria shouted at the mutinous mestizos.
And you! You funking pus-covered dogs of swine. It surely would do my sore eyes good to see you all dangling from the branches, too. What the hell shall I do with you? Peel off your stinking leather by tying you to the tails of horses and letting the Indians ride them, and after that hang you? Hang all of you? I'll get a reward from the crown for doing the job for the hangman you escaped. All right, you stinking scoundrels, I'll show you mercy, as I surely hope to receive mercy from that most holy virgin on my last day. I shall leave a hole by which you may escape. Sooner or later you will run straight into the hangman's noose anyhow, no worry about that. I won't spoil his earnings. Maybe he has a big family to feed. But make no mistake. If I ever catch any one of you again playing your nasty damn tricks against me, I tell you that you will rather wish you had been tortured by the Holy Inquisition instead of by me, you sons of lousy... Well, you know your mothers better than I can imagine them. And that's that. Get to work. Hey, wait a minute. You don't have to stay here with me. I can do without you. But there will be no wages if you leave. If you wish to stay on, I will give each one of you the horse he has been riding, and you may each keep the pistol received from me and the saddles. And maybe, I say maybe, a bonus in cash outside your wages. Now to work! Saddles mended and the mules doctored. Hustle up!
The men went off quietly.
Don't you dare to cut down that hanging devil!
She yelled after two of the gang who wanted to let the corpse down from the tree.
Leave his carcass to the buzzards. His soul is already in hell.
When the mestizos were all busy about the packs, mending broken saddles, curing the sore backs of the mules, stuffing with grass the pads of the pack saddles, and cooking their meals, Dona Maria called the Spaniard who had been faithful. Whether he would still be loyal to her tomorrow or next week, she did not know. He might get it into his head to try it next time for himself, avoiding the mistakes the other had made. He was hardly better than the hanged captain. He had only missed his chance this time. Dona Maria understood the situation very well. She knew that strong impression upon him. But Dona Maria was a woman, and he might, just because of that fact, try the same trick again and come out better, knowing her tricks. After all, he had the Indians on his side. Dona Maria understood the situation very well. She knew that she could not trust him. She had good reasons for trying to conciliate the mestizos by making them gifts they had never expected. It was now the strong point in her diplomacy to create two parties, each hating the other. In this way, she could always have one party on her side, playing it against the other. She considered which of the mestizos she would make captain of his group so as to have it under better command. The troop that was on duty during the night guarding the camp against bandits or rebellious Indians could easily overpower her and all the rest of the men, kill them, and make off with the goods. Under such conditions, it took the brains of a great leader to bring the transport to its destination. She called for the captain.
What is your name, hombre?
Ruego Padilla, Doña Maria. Ruego Padilla, sui muy humilde servidor. I am your humble servant, Doña Maria, at your very kind command.
Bien, Don Ruego.
Doña Maria laid a slight stress on the Don. Ruego was taken in. He and his hanged partner had heretofore never been addressed by Doña Maria in any other way than,
Hombre, hey!
Or,
Tuyanaka!
He felt like a soldier decorated in front of his fellows, who would never amount to anything.
Very well, Don Ruego.
Doña Maria spoke up.
I have not been blind to your great abilities. You behave like a real nobleman, a brave caballero, and a true and honest protector of a defenseless woman. I admire you for what you have done and the way you did it.
She gave him a smile. The fact was, of course, that he had done nothing in particular. He had been taken by surprise by the other captain, and, with the help of a couple of mestizos, had been tied to the tree, kicked in the ribs, and left to look at what was going to happen in the camp. Had it not been for the courage of Doña Maria, he would now have to serve his former partner or hang from a tree. Doña Maria knew this very well, but she ignored the truth and made him believe that she thought he had fought like a lion to protect her. This flattered him immensely. Yet Doña Maria had only begun to play the game to make sure of her safety for the rest of the march.
Yes. As I said, Don Ruego, you behave like a true Spanish nobleman. When we are in the capital, I shall reward you as you deserve. I shall give you...
She was about to say the mule with the whole pack on its back, but she recovered in time from this exaggerated generosity and continued.
I shall give you the right back of that mule over there, and the Indians of your troop shall divide among themselves the left back of that same mule. Those damned robbers, those funking mestizos, if they behave well from now on, shall each receive a bonus of 1/4 of what the faithful Indians shall have. Of course, Don Ruego, the horse you are riding and the pistol and the rifle you carry shall be yours as a token from me, and the Indians shall have their ponies and their pistols.
Muchas gracias, Doña Maria. I kiss your feet.
Ruego said, kissing her hand, and then added,
May I, with your very kind permission, now go look after the work?
You are handsome, Ruego. Do you know that? I never noticed that before.
She said this with a true feminine smile, looking at him with narrowed eyes.
Yes, you are handsome and very strong. Strange that I never noted you before, Ruego.
She gave him another smile.
Let's talk this over, Ruego, when we are in the capital. You know this is no time nor place to talk of such things.
Ruego snaked his body from his feet up, as if he wished to wind himself into the form of a corkscrew. Had he been covered with feathers, one might have thought him a turkey at coupling time.
Look after the men, and see that they are doing their work properly, Don Ruego. You are now the mayordomo here, and in charge of everything, the only man I can perfectly rely on.
Yes, Doña Maria, por la Santísima you can, by the Holiest Virgin you surely can, and once more, mil gracias for your kindness.
Doña Maria turned round and went to her little tent.
What brains a man has,
she said to herself. The mutiny was quashed. There was no other similar incident the rest of the way. Ruego did his part as Doña Maria expected him to. Any new uneasiness among the men could now, with the help of Ruego, be quelled at its first sign. Doña Maria had, in fact, never thought of any sort of rebellion in her own camp. There were other problems which she had taken into account. The nearer she came to more populated regions of the country, the less safe became the roads. Hordes of bandits, footpads, deserters from the army and from ships, escaped convicts, were practically everywhere. The power of the Spanish rule in Latin America was inevitably breaking to pieces. Since this rule had been nothing short of dictatorship and tyranny, conditions were as they always and everywhere are when a dictatorship is nearing its inglorious end. Dictatorships do not and cannot allow people to think politically or economically for themselves, and so, when a dictatorship is tumbling, people are in no way prepared to meet the changed conditions, and chaos is the result. Here authorities were so hard-pressed from all sides and from all quarters that they no longer could cope with the growing unrest all over the country. Day and night, Dona Maria lived in constant fear of being attacked, robbed, and murdered. Every mule and every pack on the backs of the animals had to be guarded. There were days when the whole train made hardly 10 miles, and even these 10 miles under difficulties which seemed impossible to overcome. During this journey, Dona Maria lived through a period still more trying than that of the mine. There she could not remember any day when she had felt happy and safe. She had never felt sure of her treasures. Always in fear, always worrying, and at night plagued by nightmares and terrible dreams. She could not recall a night of sound and refreshing sleep, and during the daytime she was hunted by worries and fears even worse. What had kept her spirits up during these years was the thought of the future. In imagination, she could see herself walking by the side of her duke to the throne of the king, and there curtsying and having the honor of kissing the heavy ring on the finger of his most holy majesty. The great moment finally arrived. The transport reached Mexico City without a single bar of the precious metal lost. Hardly had she reached her destination when the fame of her riches spread all over the city. The news of the arrival of the richest woman in the Spanish Empire came even to the ears of the viceroy, the most powerful person in New Spain. Dona Maria was honored with an invitation to a private audience with the viceroy, which lasted, as the whole city noted with amazement, more than an hour. Her gratitude knew no limits when this high personage promised that her treasures would be well taken care of in the vaults of the king's own treasury, the safest place in New Spain, safer than the vaults of the Bank of England in those times, guarded by the whole Spanish colonial army garrisoned in the city and under the personal guarantee of the viceroy himself. In these vaults her treasures could rest until they were transported, under the vigilance of special troops of the king, to the port of Veracruz, to be shipped from there to Spain. Dona Maria, overwhelmed by such generosity, promised the viceroy a gift in cash, which even a viceroy of New Spain could verily call most princely. Dona Maria paid off her men in full, giving them even more than she had promised for faithful service, and discharged them honorably. This done, she went to the best hotel in the city to take up quarters fit for a queen. Now, at last, she could sit down to a decent meal for the first time in many years. After so many hardships and sorrows, she could at least eat peacefully and with gusto. Then, after a most enjoyable supper, she lay down in the finest and softest bed to the sweetest slumber she had had in long, dreary years. Upon awakening, she could think of finer, sweeter, more womanly things, and of a handsome duke, perhaps a marquis. But now something happened that Dona Maria, in all her calculations, had never foreseen. Her treasures did not disappear. They were not stolen from the vaults of the king's treasury. Something else disappeared and was never seen again or heard of. And this was Dona Maria herself. She lay down in her queenly bed, but since she did so, no one has ever seen her or heard of her. She disappeared mysteriously, and nobody knew what had become of her. But while no one knew anything about Dona Maria, everyone in New Spain knew that the riches of Dona Maria had not disappeared, but were safely in the possession of one supposed to know better what to do with them than a foolish woman who thought that nobility stands for honesty. When Howard had ended his story, he added,
"I wanted to tell you this tale to show you that to find gold and to lift it out of the earth is not a whole thing. The gold has to be shipped, and shipping it is more precarious than digging and washing it. You may have a heap of it right before you and still not know if you can buy a cup of coffee and a hamburger." "Well, isn't there any chance to find out where the mine was?"
Curtin asked.
"That woman surely didn't take out all that was in it."
No, she didn't.
Howard made a face at Curtin.
There is much left, even today. Only you are late, as always, Curtie. The mine is worked by an American company, and it has yielded 10 times more than Doña Maria ever succeeded in taking out of it. You can easily find the mine, and it seems to be inexhaustible. Its name is the Doña Maria Mine, and it is located near Huacal. If you wish, you may go up and ask for a job. Maybe you can land one. If you're lucky, they may pay you 40 a week. Just try.
For a good while, the men sat in silence by the fire. Then they stood up, stretched their legs, yawned, and made ready to check in. That story is more than 100 years old. Lacaud suddenly broke the silence. Is anybody around here said it isn't? Dobbs sneered. Certainly not, Lacaud answered. But I know a good story about a rich gold mine which is only 2 years old. And just as good or better. Tell it to your grandmother. Dobbs said, we don't want any of your good stories, even if they're only a week old. They're stale already when you open your mouth. Better not say a word. What is it you are? Oh, yes, an Eterner, isn't it? A what? Lacaud looked at him with wide-open eyes. Ah, nothing, baloney. Leave me in peace.
Don't listen to him, Lakey.
Howard tried to calm Lacaud.
You mustn't take that Dobby guy seriously. Can't you see that he was born crosswise? He's still suffering from it. That's the trouble with him. If you hand him a double cut of apple pie with sweet cream, he'll scoff at you and ask why you didn't give him pumpkin pie. That's him.
Ah, you mugs. You make me sick, all of you. Dobbs made a rather dirty gesture and went to the tent, leaving the others by the fire.